Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking to Jane McKenzie about buildings going on fire. Most obviously and recently the Crooked House Pub, but Jane is a bit of an expert in things going on fire, and so we'll be talking to her about that and that trend. But firstly, I'm here with Ian Hislop, Helen Lewis and Adam McQueen. We're going to be talking about, a lot of different elements of the last fortnight's news, the bits which, you know, came out since the magazine was published last. And I thought, Helen, we could start with you and talk about, it's sort of very political summer. Politics have just kind of kept going when it shouldn't have done.
Yes. A couple of years ago, the parties realised that having a kind of silly season was very bad because into the news vacuum would creep stuff that they didn't want. So the Tories have decided, they've invented something, brace yourself for this, the week.
Oh, I love it.
So currently we're recording this in NHS week. We've previously had small boats week. But NHS week, unfortunately, has revealed the slight problem with it. I mean, this is a kind of media management strategy that goes back to the 90s and the kind of idea of the grid, that you can control things and that you would have one week where you just talk about, everybody talks about the thing you want to talk about. The problem is on the NHS, the news is really bad. So the big leading idea is they're going to abolish several of the cancer diagnosis targets, which they say will make things better, but draws attention to the fact that there are 7.5 million people now on the waiting list, an NHS waiting list, which is a record high. So you have a week to talk about something, but there's no good news to talk about. And that follows on from Small Boats Week, in which actually one very big boat, the Bibby Stockholm, had a problem. They moved migrants onto it, asylum seekers, and then they promptly moved them back off again because the water had got Legionella bacteria. So it was, you know, that was a resoundingly successful week. Another big one we're experiencing
you,
right now.
You cannot predict events. So the fact that the disease should rhyme with Suella is just incredibly funny. And that's not on the grid. And then you do Stop the Boats Week and your one boat stopped because it sank.
Yeah.
I mean, events, dear boy, is the cliche about why you can't predict politics. But I like your initial point because I thought, well, why do you think politics stops when Parliament isn't there, when Parliament was doing nothing? We had pieces in the magazine saying MPs were sort of knocking off after lunch because there wasn't any business. There was literally nothing to do. So the government pretending politics goes on all summer, it didn't go on previously.
Yeah, and it's always a desperate attempt not to talk about the economy and the fact that the inflation remains stubbornly really high. The cost of living has really bitten. Energy prices have come down a bit, obviously, but that problem is by no means solved. So it really might as well be called desperate attempt to find other things to talk about week. Yes. And indeed every week is that week.
What struck me this week, though, is there's a certain point in government's life cycles where just there's sort of the stench of death around them. It's just nothing can go right for them. And to launch Legionella bacteria is probably not something they have direct control over. That's just an incredible stroke of bad luck. And it seemed a bit like, you know, towards the end of Gordon Brown's tenure when nothing could go right at all. And then it emerged that they'd lost those data disks with kind of everyone's benefit details on and no one knew whether. And it's an endless sort of procession of things like that. And the same sort of thing at the end of John Major's government of just nothing can go right at this point. They'd be much better off not organising any weeks or grids or anything and just kind of like battening down the hatches and shutting themselves in their holiday homes and refusing to come out at all.
Well, we were wondering whether the opposition has a grid which just says, don't do anything weak, don't say anything weak, keep really quiet.
Provide weak. Enough rope. Yes.
Because he doesn't have to do anything, Starmer, does he?
No, I think that, and that is the Labour plan until the election, is just to keep going. Do you think the government has got a grip on this problem? That'd be the only thing they'll come out and say. Do you think the government has got a grip on this problem, on the NHS, on small boats?
Whereas with the government, I mean, even when they're reducing these cancer targets, all it does is draw attention to the fact that they were missing them, as you said, and that they weren't all that ambitious in the first place anyway. Almost something like two months for an initial treatment to start, which I read and thought,
whoa there!
Whoa! Yeah, yeah. That's not a brilliant target to have in the first place, is it?
They seem to have briefed people for this week to say, well, it's the doctor's fault. Well, yeah, that's not going to go down hugely well, is it?
Let's just remind everyone that doctors are walking out because they're not being paid enough. Yes, it's
yes,
not.
That's the thing. They're trying to say that, you know, the doctors actually want the waiting list targets simplified. And that may be true, but you're right, Adam. It has got to the point when they can't get a hearing on that because everyone just assumes you're scrapping these because they're so long. I think that is the problem. They've got themselves into a plate, that hole they kind of can't climb out of.
And the second you get all the media get any kind of doctor on to comment on it, the obvious thing they're going to say is, well, there's not enough money. We need more money to go into cancer treatment or any other cause that you care to come up with. So immediately that's throwing things back on the government and on the state of the economy as well, isn't it?
We were talking a little earlier, Helen, about the risk that by cleaving so closely to a lot of Conservative talking points and policies, that Starmer's slightly, you know, letting all the air out of the already quite squashy ball of enthusiasm for him. Is there a...
ball of enthusiasm.
I did throw that in between us talking and now. But my point is that... And you didn't think that was a serious risk. You don't think there is a serious risk of enthusiasm vanishing. What there is.
Yeah, I think the problem with those culture war issues is that they work in the sense of giving people an idea what a government is about, broadly where they are. And if you want to realign the Labour Party, as Keir Starmer has done, then making statements on culture war issues is actually quite helpful because it's quite decisive. But in the way that I think David Cameron felt about Brexit, you know, always banging on about Europe, a lot of the ways that the Tories are currently using culture wars is actually quite repellent. It just seems sort of monomaniacal. And, you know, when I watch Suella Braverman talking, I don't think, wow, this is a, you know, politician who's got a lot to say about a lot of subjects. I think this is somebody that I would be harangued by on a train and I would try and escape. And I think that's, you know, the Republicans are seeing that in the US in a way that they're kind of the dog that caught the car with abortion. So amazing, we Dobbs decision means we repeal the constitutional right to abortion. And now what's happening is that they are losing congressional seats, in senatorial seats. That's not a word. What do I mean? Senate seats. Because people don't like extreme abortion politics. Most people are moderates. And I think the same is probably true of Britain. Actually, most people believe in a strong, maybe even tough immigration regime. They don't necessarily want a government that wangs on about its prison ships all the time.
The latest tragedy involved Afghans. And again, there has been a wave of sympathy in this country over Afghanistan and the people who we either helped or failed to help escape in the first place. And so it's not a group from a safe country. This is a country we're currently pretending to be very upset about. You can't predict how this is going to go just by saying this is what we will talk about.
And that was I think that boat that sank in the Channel, that came a couple of days after Sunak's latest as part of his Boats Week video, where he was doing his enthusiastic, slightly preppy, you know, five points to camera about what is being done about this. And one of his was, I've increased the raids. And he said it in this really, really chirpy way, but it was matched with footage of obviously a really, really heavily armoured guy smashing in a door with a battering ram. And the whole thing felt a little bit off to, I think, most people.
It's extraordinary they haven't learned about this. There have been so endless photo shoots with Priti Patel and Suella Braverman and Boris Johnson
going on
a couple
raids
as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
Where they put on the kind of the police armour and then just stand there looking smug while people have their doors kicked down. And it's one of those things. I mean, I think it repulses as many people as it might kind of attract. I mean,
it's never followed up. By the end of the video, it doesn't say, we arrested 35 people, smugglers. They've been put away for 9 months. The route that they were operating has been closed down. We don't get that bit, presumably.
You never find out what happened to the actual people who were apprehended in the raids, do you?
No.
There's no follow-on story at all, presumably because they're living in premier inns in various places around the country while their claims are processed, I guess, or on the Bibby Stockholm, or off the Bibby Stockholm again. Maybe back by the time that by the time this podcast goes out.
Just wanted to pick up about the fact that I think what I saw there was quite a good Rishi Sunak impression.
Oh, no. No, because I've already had the you look like a young Michael Gove for a few years. And it's not...
That's incredibly accurate.
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Honestly, with the right glasses on and the, you know, a pouty lip.
Okay,
so now
go
I've got
to
a second...
The private IHR department and complain that I bullied you by pointing out
thank
you had a good Rishi
thank
Sunak
you
impression.
Oh, God,
but you
yeah
do, and I would like to compliment you on it.
It comes naturally.
Anyway, I think we should move on from this one.
Adam, tell us about Dan Wootton. And I think tell us for the uninitiated, maybe the listener who doesn't watch as much GB News as they'd like to.
Well, this is an extraordinary story, this Dan Wootton. Dan Wootton is a journalist who's featured a great deal in Street of Shame over the years. He's never a man who's made himself popular with his colleagues at the News of the World, where he worked initially. And then he was a columnist on the Daily Mail for a while, renowned for being described by Paul Dacre as the worst columnist in Fleet Street. Well, Paul Dacre was employing him on his own newspaper, something he's very definitely regretting now. Then he went back to The Sun. He was kind of showbiz supremo at The Sun. He kept acquiring even bigger and grander titles. And then he became a talk radio presenter. He was determined to have a career in the media, but then flounced off to The Sun's News UK, the Sun publisher's great rival, GB News, just at the point where the Sun was setting up Talk TV, which, again, as career moves go, it was probably not a brilliant one, because although Dan is now at GB News, a great rival to News UK, all of the personnel records remain at The Sun and are proving some slightly awkward reading for an investigation that has now been launched by none other than the chief counsel at News UK, Angus McBride, he of defending Rebecca Brooks from phone hacking charges, incredibly successfully a few years ago, fame, into some quite extraordinary accusations against Dan, which have been made largely in an online paper called Byline Times by two former colleagues of Dan's at the News of the World, Dan Evans and Tom Latcham. I mean, I would encourage anyone to read this. There's about 10 articles. They keep on coming. And each time, the accusations in them seem to be more extraordinary than the last. So the main ones that are being investigated at The Sun are that Dan solicited, in the guise of someone called Martin Branning, nude photographs and videos from various colleagues who he fancied.
Where was he being employed when he was asking young reality TV contestants to come round to his house to do underwear shoots?
Again, this was the latest one. This was the this was at The Sun. So there was always an extremely special relationship between Simon Cowell's X Factor and The Sun, who kind of got all sorts of exclusives. But it turned out that doesn't appear to have been quite enough, because Dan also was soliciting other exclusives from various people who have gone on record with Byline Times. One of them, there's a couple from the X Factor. There's one is Kirk Norcross from The Only Way of Essex, which I know you're a big fan, Ian.
Yeah, no, I was waiting for his name to come up. What kind of story is this?
Not only did Dan Wootton apparently ask to come round to his flat and pose for some underwear shots, but then when this came out in the Byline Times most recently, he got in touch with Kirk Norcross again and asked him to contribute to his legal crowdfund in order that he could sue the Byline Times for saying that this had happened, which is a sort of level of effrontery that, in a way, you almost have to admire, don't you?
How much of it has Dan Wootton denied? Because my understanding was that he's denied some bits of it in a quite a careful way. He's never denied being Martin Branning or using that name.
He's never answered any questions about Martin Branning or a couple of other pseudonyms of people who turned up asking various people for these nude photos and things. Yeah. It's very sort of unspecific denials. He initially said that he denied doing anything illegal. He has now, as reported in The Last Eye, taken on a new lawyer, a rather cheaper lawyer, because he was with Mishkon de Rea, who are quite pricey. And when the various other people, as well as Kurt Norcross, declined to contribute to his crowdfunding efforts, he's gone to the slightly cheaper Griffin Law. And a charming fellow called Donald Blaney, who readers might remember for a few years ago, was involved in that Young Conservatives bullying scandal. And Donald Blaney's part in this was that he set up what he'd like to call Tory madrassas to train up the next generation of Conservative activists.
Yes.
This is all very much part of that same axis that Dan Wootton kind of got onto with GB News, of this kind of new right and the war on woke. And
yeah,
Donald
the
Blaney
Rainbow
is very...
Taliban. I've heard of them.
Donald Blaney is very, very much a part of this.
Can I just rewind a bit? The reason that we're quite interested in the fact that Dan Wootton has, you know, alleged to have done all these things is because he was quite critical of some other people in the media.
One or two, yeah. One of the most vocal people during the Philip Schofield scandal a few months ago, demanding that Philip Schofield be taken off air immediately before he'd admitted to anything, and saying that that was completely inappropriate for him to be on air whilst allegations about him were being made and until a full investigation was done. Dan Wootton remains on air at GB News to this day. And also, famously, Dan's most glorious moment in journalism was when he was sued by Johnny Depp for writing a column in The Sun which said that no one in Hollywood should work with Johnny Depp after accusations had been made about his own personal behaviour. So, you know, for him now, as he has done, as we've noted in The Eye, to be saying, should I be cancelled for things that I have done in the past and mistakes I may have made? Well, judging by your own views on these things, yeah, it's pretty clear, isn't it?
His crowdfunder, because we had a look at his crowdfunder last week, where he's raising, I think he's trying to raise £150,000.
Yeah, the lesson from this is never, ever put a target on a crowdfunder, I think, because obviously everyone will then measure it against it. So he said he needed £150,000 to pay his legal fees.
Dan's been very clear. They mostly relate to his political views. He's been besmirched for his attempts to fight for the truth for the viewers of GB News. And that's actually, I mean, that's really what's behind all this.
It's a bit like me saying, I have never bullied Andy over his Michael Gove impression. I deny that flatly, leaving aside all the bullying I've done of you over your other impressions.
And again, coming slightly back at this, we've had Philip Schofield, Hugh Edwards, and now Dan Wootton. Is this homophobia?
Gosh, that's a big question.
That was my Elton John impression.
I think my answer to that will probably be that no, on the grounds that, I mean, if you suddenly realise, as appeared to be the case with Hugh Edwards, that at a quite late stage in your life, your 50s and 60s, you are attracted to men as well as women. You don't immediately need to start giving large amounts of money to very young men online to give you nude pictures.
Yes.
Those are actually available on the internet for free. You might want to have a look. If you're Dan Wooten and you take a fancy to any of your male colleagues, I mean, it's something I've got experience of because, as mentioned, all of my colleagues here look like Michael Gove. So it's never been an issue in this office. But I have to say, I mean, my approach would probably say, would you like to go for a drink sometime? Rather than set up an elaborate online persona and then then solicit nude photographs and videos from them. I don't know. Call me crazy. It seems like a lot of effort to go to.
Speak for yourself. Who
have I been sending all mine to then?
They just go to the front desk and we have a look them down there.
The other thing about this is these stories where they arrive, blaze of publicity, and then they disappear very quickly. So we haven't heard anything about Hugh Edwards since, what, 2 days after the story broke that it was actually him? So what's going on there?
It was literally that same afternoon. If you remember, the chronology of it was that Hugh Edwards is... the police announced that they weren't investigating any kind of criminal allegations against him, and that put pay to all of the speculation that had been in the Sun with their curious wording about children and, well, specific wording about a 17-year-old. So that kind of put pay to that story, which in a way was the public interest angle on it. And then within 5 minutes of that, Hugh Edwards' wife had come out with the statement, drafted for her by Andy Coulson, because everyone always turns up in the most unlikely things. Andy Coulson. And of course, Rebecca Brooks's co-defendant and Paramore, former Paramore, in the dock on those
and
phone hacking charges.
One of the duo who actually went to jail.
He did indeed.
Rebecca Brooks is innocent. I always want to remind people of that fact in case they cynically.
Yes, of course, absolutely innocent of everything and knew nothing about anything. Not the only one who went to jail. There were several other News of the World journalists who went to jail for phone hacking as well. And then, of course, at the same time, we had the fake sheikh, Mazen Mahmood, also went to jail for perjury. There was a hell of a lot going on at the News of the World, wasn't there? There really was.
These brackets have got way too big now because I think we left it at Hugh Edwards' wife.
We started with Hugh Edwards' wife drafting a statement with the help of Andy Coulson, which in itself is quite funny. It's not a funny story, but it is amazing how life turns, that someone who literally went to jail for phone hacking is now drafting a statement about the rights of privacy of various public figures. Andy Coulson, the editor of the News of the World.
If you go into PR and say that you specialise in crisis management, I mean, there are a few people kind of more more qualified crisis, on their own CV, are there, I guess. But I think the key part of that statement, which kind of killed the Hugh Edwards story, at least for now, was the line in it that said he has now checked into hospital and is undergoing mental health treatment, which... Again, I was reminded actually of Kevin Spacey, another person who it now turns out court has found is absolutely innocent of absolutely everything. This was the line that he followed as well, wasn't it, when that whole scandal blew up in the first place, was he said he was checking into rehab for, I think, sort of non-specific things, but it is a way to kind of, at least as a PR person, if you're being very cynical about it, give yourself some breathing space on a story.
The weirdest one of all those, if you remember, the first holding statement from Harvey Weinstein was that he was going to set up a sort of feminist scholarship in memory of his mother and fight the NRA. And it was genuinely very weird to write it. And I encourage anyone as a student of media to go and read it as clearly someone, probably very expensive crisis management PR, told him that was a good idea. Or maybe they didn't and he just went, I'm going to be fine, everything's fine, showing the level of judgment that he exercised the rest of his career. But yes, I don't know where that leaves us. But
the NRA.
It was a very, very bizarre... The worst thing...
The National Rifle Association.
Yeah, he was going to say, basically, I'm going to put loads of money into progressive politics. You know, I've always cared about this. Yes, I may have done a few things that now I reflect on, they weren't quite... As it turns out, masturbating into pot plants and sexually assaulting people. But I'm going to have a scholarship in memory of my mother, who was in many ways a woman.
Maybe this is the way forward for Dan Wooten to give up all of GP News and have a road to Damascus moment and say that he's now a convert to liberal politics and he's going to spend the rest of the time fighting for feminism.
But he used to be very left wing. I mean, he used to be.
He famously was on the lefty side of the sun, as much as that counts as anything.
Right.
He was most notorious for arguing in an editorial meeting, and this is, gives you an idea of the pomposity of the British tabloids when they were deciding to decide who they were going to back in the U.S. election between Trump and Hillary Clinton. And Dan Wotton made a very big argument that they should be backing Hillary at this point, and that this was the way forward.
That reminds me about the fact that one of the senior journalists at the Mail when I worked there described me as a red under the bed. So my leaving page has got, is there a red under your bed and a picture of me. It was me. I was the most left-wing person at the Daily Mail. A hotly contested title, as you might imagine.
Well, at least you weren't the worst columnist on Fleet Street. So.
I think we should turn to a properly summary. You know, this is all a bit newsy for my liking. It's mid-August, so Edinburgh Fringe time.
Just way.
Because there was a little piece in the last mag about the funniest jokes of the Fringe. And it was a piece that the Telegraph had run, the 30 funniest jokes of the Edinburgh Fringe. They were one-liners. They were great fun. They were all very amusing. And there was a bit of a strange thing there, because how do you know what the funniest jokes of the Fringe are on the 4th of August? Most people haven't seen any of the shows. Nobody had reviewed anything, which is another aspect of the Fringe, which this year is more advanced than ever, is just no papers have dispatched many, you know, reviewers and things like that. But anyway, there were these 30 jokes. And what RP said was that these were all submitted to the Telegraph, a lot of them by the same PR company, and that they were just, you know, comedians just get asked, can you pick one line from your show? We will try and get it in somewhere. You will get a link to your show, and that's it. And it was a bit of a depressing State of the Fringe piece.
Yeah,
in that sense.
It struck me as a bit of a sort of bit of a metaphor, really, for the commercialization of the Fringe. And I know old people have been saying, oh, the Fringe is so commercial, for the last 380 years or however long it's been. So it's not exactly new, but at least there was a feeling when it went up to the Fringe, maybe someone would see your show and there would be a joke in it that someone would find funny. I found the idea that it had already been corporatized, and that a PR company picked the jokes. Journalists, you know, either too lazy or it's too expensive to send someone out there to see it. So the jokes are being selected for you. I just found that incredibly depressing.
It's so tragic because it's laid on in August for newspapers to fill their pages with. Yeah. It's got the potential there. You don't even understand. You get to go on a freebie. You get to sit and see a show. You've got to file 300 words. You get that. And now the state of the media is such that people can't even be bothered to do that. They've got PR companies to do it for them, and they just put the press release in.
Yeah, and can't afford to as well. I mean, sending a hack to Edinburgh for the month of August, you've got to put them up there. That's really expensive.
And you've just sent hundreds of people to Glastonbury, so how can you be expected to do that as well?
But I ask you a potentially triggering question, Andrew, what is the least number of people you've ever performed to at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe?
So are you asking about, I think her name's Georgia Greer?
Who posted on Twitter a photo of her crying in a very photogenic way, saying only two people turned up. No, hang a minute. Only one person turned up to my show. And lots of comedians very sweetly replied. And then the next day the show was sold out. Anyway, it then transpired she'd done it the previous year when two people, her parents, turned up to the show. And I think, as I said to you, this is the spirit of the Fringe, which is sort of maudlin weeping and self-promotion. So I was in favour of it.
I wish I'd thought of putting up a photo of me blubbing at the Fringe. In answer to your question, which is actually very, very personal, you know, that's kind of bank account stuff. That's, you know, that's really... it was, I think, 2015 or 16, and it was... I was doing a two-person show, and for our very first preview, we had four people in the audience, two of whom left halfway through. And there was a real hinge moment of, gosh, we've done 35 minutes, and now we're on, like... even Stevens with the audience, we could just knock it on the head here.
Was the thinking if there were less people in the audience than were in the show, that was the point at which you gave up? So you just had to keep both of them there.
Well, there's always a technician, you know. There's always someone on the lights. And if they keep the lights nice and low, then it's possible the people around them will think the room is full.
It's fine. You're very successful now.
The thing is that lots of shows have this experience, you know. And it's now that the Free Fringe and the Free Festival are such huge things, it's easier to get a handful of people, you know, like 10 or 15 people in a room. But lots of people go the whole month just playing to almost nobody, and it's incredibly depressing. And there are a whole load of factors, but I just wanted to give a shout out to a comedian called Mark Adams, who in the last couple of days has announced he's selling halfway through the run his slot. He's got an 8:30 slot, a 60 seater, and he's done eight shows, each with a maximum of six people, and he said, I just can't do this anymore. So he's selling the slot for about £100 a night to anyone who wants it, and he's kind of giving up. And he's not going viral with it or anything. It's just that's the reality of performing for a month at the Fringe for a lot of acts.
Is there not a slot for a Rishi Sunak impression?
Oh, God! Can I have 2 weeks off here? And I've just had a brilliant idea. Ian Hislop there. Thanks to him, to Adam McQueen, and no thanks to Helen Lewis. And for the record, my one-man show, Rishi, will be on at the Counting House at 2:30 p.m. every day for the rest of the run. It's free, so please do get there in advance. Now, we turn to buildings catching fire under mysterious circumstances for the second half of this week's episode. The Crooked House is a pub in the West Midlands that caught fire and burned nearly to the ground about a week ago and was then demolished in a terrible bulldozer accident just a couple of days after that. One of the Eyes correspondents who knows a great deal about buildings mysteriously going up in flames, mysteriously being demolished, all that sort of thing, is Jane McKenzie, who writes the magazine's Nooks and Corners column about historic architecture and what happens to historic architecture when it's not properly preserved. So I sat down with Jane to ask her all about the subject of buildings going up in smoke. Here she is.
Just before the story of the Crooked House burning down, we had a story in the column for this issue about a building we'd written about twice before in the column when it was under threat of demolition. This is a weatherboarded house from around 1800, which is in Framlingham. And there'd been a long case of that seeking planning permission to replace it with a semi-detached house, and which had been refused, and so it was not allowed to be demolished, and much celebrating by the lovers of 18th century traditional buildings.
Sure.
Earlier this year, when the demolition was refused, and unfortunately last month it went on fire.
Okay, and again, I don't know what we're able to say about that one, whether that seems to have, does that seem to have been arson? Does it seem to have been an accident? Do we know?
Well, I believe, again, there's investigation as to the source of ignition. But buildings that are empty and are derelict are at great risk of going on fire. Right. Whether that's arson, vandalism, that's not intentionally setting a building on fire, but is somebody breaking in for a smoke, or people stealing parts of the building, perhaps the pipes if they're valuable, that kind of thing. It might cause sparks, especially in the summer. Buildings can be at more risk. And derelict, neglected buildings don't usually have much in the way of fire suppression systems. So they're just generally at risk of fire.
Which is a disaster for the people who own the building, but not always.
Absolutely. Sometimes it can be very convenient for the people who own the building and who had alternative plans for the space. That's very helpful to them. If the building is neglected for so long, it eventually burns down or falls down. That also happens to buildings that are neglected a long time.
And you've seen this happen quite a lot, I think, in the time that you've been writing Nooks and Corners.
Well, that's right. And long before I was writing Nooks and Corners, obviously, Pilotti, Gavin Stamp, wrote about a lot of buildings in Glasgow that went on fire. In fact, that's where the went on fire phrase comes from. That is the Glasgow vernacular for buildings catching fire. And Glasgow was particularly vulnerable for a while to buildings going on fire.
Okay, and you'd think slightly cooler up in Scotland, slightly damper maybe. Quite surprising that so many buildings going on fire.
Apparently, from reading Gavin's old columns, Glasgow Council and Scottish law was slightly softer on building owners. For instance, London councils have forced absolute rebuilds of buildings that have been lost to demolition and fire and the like. They were getting away with it more often in Glasgow.
Right. So what's really interesting about when you write about these buildings is that it's normally not someone going around with like a barrel of kerosene and then dropping a match. It's normally not quite that open and shut.
It's very rarely so blatant. I mean, one case I've previously written about in the column, beautiful, partly Elizabethan mansion in Dorset called Parnham House, where that is what is suspected insurance fraud, arson, literally.
Right.
the building had various problems and the owner was suspected of having burned it down. Now, that investigation came to a full stop when he was found drowned 2 months after the fire.
Right.
But it was believed that it was an insurance fraud.
And as you've said, insurance is one potential motivation, but it's not the only motivation, particularly if you're trying to develop lucrative land, basically. Yeah.
Yes. Sometimes an owner won't be even attempting to claim the insurance if the land possibly is more valuable without the building on it.
In terms of the punishments that are dished out to people who, let's say you own a historic building, you neglect it, it goes on fire, maybe it can't be proved it's arson. What sanctions are there for people who mistreat historic buildings in that way?
So there are substantial fines that can be handed out. They're not used as often as they should be because councils don't necessarily prioritise sort of the legal fees that are involved in taking that kind of case through the courts. But people have been fined tens of thousands of pounds for building bad modern extensions on their sort of grade 2-star listed homes. Also, they can use various enforcement powers to do things like force rebuilding or force repairs. There's the famous case of the pub in Maida Vale, the Carlton Tavern.
Oh, yeah.
That was rebuilt, the phrase is, brick by brick. And it does look exactly like a slightly more polished version of the original.
And you were making the point that that is a great sanction that can be dished out in some cases. But in the case of the Crooked House, for example, what are you going to build back a pub at a 15-degree angle?
That's mystified me, because I know the West Midlands mayor was calling for it to be rebuilt. But I don't know whether they would build it straight and then collapse a mine under it and hope that it went beautifully wonky like the other one, or whether it would be a sort of pastiche of a crooked. It's hard to see how it could have the sort of genuine feel of the Crooked House with a rebuild.
Surely you wouldn't be able to get permission for to build a death trap, wonky pub, would you?
I don't know. There's another case of a pub that was demolished that we wrote about in the column, the Punch Bowl in Lancashire. It was demolished. There was no fire involved. It was just after several years of wrangling between the owners and the council planning department, they obviously lost their tempers and demolished the building. They've been prosecuted over it. And as well as the sanctions against them for carrying out unauthorised demolition, they have been told to rebuild. The problem there is that it's not a building that would get permission to be built nowadays, partly because of the location right on a busy road and a very difficult space to pull into the car park. Okay. So it's difficult to order them to rebuild what people would be objecting to on safety grounds if it was being applied to for the first time.
Yeah, and you said something else that was really interesting about that case. That was it that they wanted to turn it into holiday let cottages, that land?
Yes.
They wanted to get rid of the pub and replace it with holiday let cottages.
Well, they wanted to retain the walls of originally.
Okay.
There was much of the toing and froing was over taking the roof off in order to convert this lovely old pub into some holiday cottages, which would have been sort of quaint and an old pub.
And might have brought in money, as in the pub was probably not going to bring in money because
it's not in a village. It was a slightly isolated pub. It was hard to see how it would have been viable as a pub, unfortunately.
Because you'd have to drink and drive to go there, basically.
Well, persuade somebody to drive you there.
Yeah. So that feels like a situation that almost kind of incentivize them to do the destroying and see what happened afterwards.
Well, it's certainly one of those cases where the complexities of which buildings to protect and how much of kind of we must preserve in aspic the buildings that we sort of see as traditional.
Yeah.
Occasionally, it's very, very hard for something to remain viable in the use that it had 200 years ago.
Do you think there's a prospect of things changing enough that the amount of buildings going on fire declines or can be brought down?
I think so. I think I don't think as many buildings as used to go on fire in Glasgow, for instance, go on fire now.
Okay.
The listing process is there to be used, so please, if you love your local buildings, don't let them stand there unlisted. Just because they're well looked after now, in 10 years, they might have changed hands and somebody might be planning to do something dreadful to them. Mm. So, and different areas of the country have different levels of listing. Some councils at various points have been very good and made a concerted effort to make sure that the things that should be listed are. That's not happened everywhere. And some places have local associations that have done that work. So if you've got a very effective local history society, they might have got the applications in. But in other areas, that might not have happened. So seriously, if you love a local building, get it listed.
That's great. We never end with a call to action on this podcast, and I don't know why we haven't until now. That's great.
Excellent.
But yeah. Thank you very much, Jane. That is it for this episode of Page 94. We will be back again in a fortnight with another one. Until then, you can get hold of the magazine. You can even get a subscription by going to private-i.co.uk. As ever, this episode was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye now.